It's normal for the cost of goods and services to rise steadily over time. But many countries are reporting major increases in the prices of food, housing and energy. It's been called the cost of living crisis, and developing nations are hurting the most. Is there a way out? And what could happen if inflation remains high? I'm Kim Vanell, and you're listening to the Inside Story podcast, where we dissect, analyse and help define major global stories. All right, let's bring in our guests in Britain's capital. Jeevan Santha, economist and political scientist at King's College London. In India's capital, New Delhi, Kalyani Raghunathan, an economist and research fellow at the International Food Policy Research Institute. And in Geneva, in Switzerland, Stella Nordhagen, senior technical specialist at the Global Alliance for Improved Nutrition. A very warm welcome to the programme to all of you. I'd like to start with you, Jeevan Santha. What is driving this cost of living crisis?
So there's really three things that we've seen leading to rising prices across the globe. There were supply chain disruptions in the wake of COVID, far more expensive to ship goods from country to country. And then we saw Russia's invasion of Ukraine really driving up increasing energy and food prices even further. And finally, rich nations printing lots of cash for quantitative easing and keeping interest rates for too low. That was the right decision to get us through the pandemic, but they left them too low for too long, and that's led to rising prices as well.
Okay. I'd like to cross over to you, Kalyani Raghunathan. What impact is this rising cost of living having right now on people's nutrition, particularly in the developing world?
It's having strong impacts on both food security and nutrition. So I think food security and just having access to enough food is sort of a prerequisite to be able to have healthy or nutritious diets. The problem with India is that we have a lack of data on what's happening nationwide, but a lot of primary surveys that we have conducted, both as a research institute, but also that the Hunger Watch, led by the Right to Food India campaign, has conducted, has shown that the food insecurity situation is really poor. So we administered a set of 8 questions from the Global Food Insecurity Experience Scale, and more than 80% of our respondents reported experiencing at least one form of food insecurity. So people are worried about having enough food. They're worried about having enough healthy and nutritious food. And then that plays out not only in getting enough food onto the plates, but also in what is making it onto those plates. So social safety nets can actually provide cereals or pulses, you know, foods that can be easily stored and transported. But we're seeing a real lacuna when it comes to people eating fruits, vegetables, milk, flesh foods, eggs, and things that are both getting more expensive, but that are also harder to transport, harder to store. And those are the items that we're really looking at when we're looking at a nutritious diet.
When was this research done? Was this before the pandemic? Was this before Russia's invasion of Ukraine? Have things gotten worse?
So my hypothesis would be that things are getting worse because we're seeing record inflation in the country, and across the board, you know, the prices of food items are rising, not just because of Russia and Ukraine, but also the rising price of edible oils, which constitute a big portion of our imports and also what goes onto the Indian plate. But the surveys that I'm referring to predate all of this. So these are actually surveys that were conducted over the course of the last 2 years. And so these are essentially pointing to impacts of COVID and related sort of unemployment and inflation crises that crisis caused. And so the Hunger Watch survey in particular that I'm referencing, data was collected in December of last year and January of this year. So it wasn't a particularly bad period with respect to COVID infections. It also was before the Russia-Ukraine war, and so predated that sort of rise in food prices. And already the situation was extremely poor at that time.
Okay. Stella Nordhagen, you're with the Global Alliance for Improved Nutrition. You're a senior technical specialist. We've just talked about a couple of factors going on here, contributing to the cost of living going up. COVID and supply chain issues, the war in Ukraine, and inflation. Given those factors, what is the state of global food systems right now?
Good question. It's challenging, I think, is the way to put it in a word. I think it's important to realize that even before the pandemic, even before the war in Ukraine, even before the current shocks to the economic systems and supply chains, we weren't exactly in a position of strength when it comes to food systems, particularly from a nutrition perspective. A UN report released using pre-pandemic data found that 3 billion people worldwide were unable to afford a healthy diet. In addition, we see that over a third of the world's population is afflicted by some form of malnutrition, whether that's simply not getting enough calories to eat, whether that's not getting the micronutrients that are important for development and for avoiding disease, or whether that's getting too much and being affected by obesity, overweight, and diet-related non-communicable diseases. So the world's food systems weren't really delivering for nutrition even before COVID. COVID added on to that by affecting both the supply chains that bring food to people and affecting the livelihoods that people are able to leverage to access nutritious foods and to ensure their food security and nutrition. And now, as my colleagues have mentioned, we're adding on to that with another layer of disruptions and another layer of food prices that are affecting many different types of foods, staple foods, but as my colleague in India mentioned, also edible oils, which are an important component of diets as well. And this is really kind of pinching people when they already didn't have a lot of flexibility within their budgets to ensure that they were eating nutritious diets.
Jeevan Santa, from an economic perspective, from sort of a more macro perspective, was this cost of living crisis predictable even without the war in Ukraine, as we went through the pandemic and governments started spending and there were lockdowns and there were going to be supply chain issues? Was this situation foreseeable?
It was somewhat foreseeable. Certainly around the turn this year, we kind of thought prices were going to rise. We should have realised at that point that every single time we were getting a new set of inflation figures, they were higher than we were expecting. We were also seeing that unemployment had fallen to very low levels. I think it was, in a sense, foreseeable. I think central banks were a little bit slow to really kind of realize we're actually having this starting to become embedded. And as soon as kind of Putin did invade Ukraine, we then started to see, of course, those prices were going to rise further. We knew how much wheat was coming from that area, as well as the impact it was going to have on oil and gas prices, somewhat foreseeable. But now we're here, the question is, how do we deal with this going forward? And look, you know, we've got a quarter of a billion people more facing extreme poverty, around half a billion more facing hunger and political upheaval as well. Prime ministers overthrown so far in Pakistan and Sri Lanka. It's a global crisis. It is affecting everyone. But now that we are here, it's actually incumbent on us to make sure that people have enough money in their pockets, as well as, of course, enough food to eat.
Jeevan, how equipped are lower income countries to deal with this crisis?
So not very well equipped. I mean, look, they're already going through difficulties during COVID itself. We're now seeing something like 60% of low and lowering middle income nations are in debt distress. They're struggling. They don't have the same kind of borrowing capacity that the richest nations have. And so really, this is a global crisis. It does take a global response. You know, for some countries, they are able to, for example, I'm here in the UK, they are able to feed their population, make sure everyone gets enough money in their pockets, but some countries, particularly those in lower and lower middle income nations, can't afford it. We really need to see rich nations step up at that point, supply more humanitarian aid, and most importantly as well, get that 0.7% of aid to GDP target.
Kalyani Raghunathan, what are the gender imbalances when you look at the impact of this crisis, how women and perhaps non-binary folks are impacted?
Yeah, that's a great question, and it's a good one in the context of sort of diets and food insecurity in India, but also in South Asia. There's a lot of anecdotal evidence that women often eat last and eat least. So if there is a food crisis and there's a limited amount of nutritious food to go around, then typically it's the woman in the household who will get the smallest portion of that. And so there's some evidence that when times are bad, it's actually the women and vulnerable populations that get hit first. I think in the context of India, there are all kinds of other layers as well. So we've been seeing a female labor force employment crisis as well, falling labor force participation over the last many years. That means a lot of women are either withdrawing from the workforce entirely or moving from sort of full-time employment to part-time, more precarious employment. So I think just to pick up on what Stella had said earlier, in the context of these repeated shocks, when we're seeing that households might have an ability to kind of buffer a short-term shock, but when it's one thing after another, your sort of coping strategies are drawing down on assets and resorting to selling livestock and other things that kind of affect your long-term ability to bounce back. I think more broadly, women are often the ones who are hit the worst by crisis of this kind, and particularly in the context of South Asia when it comes to diets, they often get the short end of the stick.
Mm-hmm. Stella Nordhagen, I was interested to find out that chemical fertilizers require a large amount of fossil fuels for production, and therefore chemical fertilizers have become much more expensive, and that is going to impact the amount of crops. So does that mean that this crisis is going to be prolonged?
It's certainly another factor that is adding to the disruption. As you noted, chemical fertilizers are one other area where there are constraints within the supply chain in terms of access to raw materials. For example, urea is a key element in fertilizer. Much of that is produced in Belarus, which is affected by some of the trade restrictions that have been put in place following the war. And that kind of ripples through the entire food system, because fertilizer is used for so many different crops in so many different places. And many countries are really dependent on global markets for accessing that fertilizer. If you look across Africa, you can see multiple examples of countries that are dependent on imports, primarily from Europe, for over 50% of their fertilizers. So these effects of limited access to fertilizer, high prices for fertilizer, can have really large effects. And like you said, it does add this one other factor. And at the level of kind of inputs, the very beginning of the agricultural production system, that needs to be worked out before all the other stages of the food system can adapt to that disruption. If there's a problem at inputs, that means that there'll be a problem at production, which means there'll be a problem at retail, which means that there'll be a problem at consumption of food. Mm. So a disruption to inputs like fertilizer can really perpetuate throughout the entire food value chain, and like you suggested, have lasting effects that can take more time to sort out than any single disruption to, say, food prices might.
Jeevan Sander, what role has China played in the supply chain issues? Because it has continued to have this zero COVID approach policy, continued lockdowns. So what impact is China having here globally?
A huge impact, certainly, perhaps one of the largest. Those lockdowns are stopping goods getting back and forth, but in particular as well, containers and shipping containers are just in the wrong places to ship goods around. You know, we can't get goods from place to place. In the UK, for example, containers being shipped across 10 times as expensive as they were before the pandemic. Every single kind of price is being impacted by the fact that just not having kind of the boxes in the right place to ship things is costing us. It's also going to continue having an impact as well. You know, China now is an incredibly large player in the global economic sphere. When its growth falls, it will fall because of repeated lockdowns. That's also going to hit everyone else's growth as well. So you've got one problem is you can't get goods back and forth, but also one nation that isn't spending and producing as much, and that means less as well for the economy and the global economy as a whole.
Kalyani Raghunathan, what's your take on India's response to the COVID-19 pandemic and how that has impacted the cost of living crisis that the country is facing now? And also your take on how the government is trying to address it more generally?
So I think initially at the start of the crisis, there was a lot of confusion in the way the COVID lockdown was implemented. And there's a lot of evidence in the short term from around the end of March 2020 up until around June or July of the same year that showed that there were severe disruptions to supply chains. And a lot of this emanated from sort of contradictory or incomplete instructions about, you know, the transport of food across state lines. And that led to a lot of disruptions in those supply chains, particularly for goods like fruits and vegetables that had to be sort of had a very precarious supply chain from farm to table. And so that caused a lot of a strong impact on prices initially. A lot of the data that looks at food prices and how those kind of reacted to COVID notes that following July, things stabilized. So there is some evidence also from our own research that shows that systems adapted over time. So this is not necessarily a function of government action, I'm sure it was helped by that, but also just figuring out, you know, how supply chains can be shored up Online buying in big cities stabilized after a matter of months. What I think is crucial to note here is that the Hunger Watch survey that we conducted found that social safety nets were really, really important. And I think in the first 1.5 years of the pandemic, the government really did invest not only in the public distribution system, which already provides a large amount of cereals to poor households, but also in supplementing that through additional programs. And we found in our research that a lot of the poor and vulnerable households really depended on those extra kilograms of rice or pulses that they received. And so I think from a social safety net perspective, that was a really good endeavor. The other was that we found that workfare programs, so the large workfare program, the National Rural Employment Guarantee Act, demand for work under that program really spiked. And so having that program in place was really helpful because people, particularly migrant laborers who moved back from the cities to rural areas, were able to actually find something to do and earn an income. So I'll just say one thing, just picking up from one of the points you had made earlier about how lower income countries are actually placed to respond to these crises. I would actually say that because we do have in place systems like the public distribution system, large workfare programs, ways of making transfers both in cash and in kind to vulnerable populations, in a sense, we do have the machinery in place that should be able to be put into use in crises of these kinds. I'm not sure that we've done enough. I'm also not sure that we're continuing to do this even as the COVID crisis recedes, but other crises take its place.
Stella Nordhagen, what is the impact of climate change and extreme weather events been on crops and the food supply chain?
It's one more stress. It's a stress that we've seen over many years, but increasing in severity, increasing in frequency, and looking at the projections that have been undertaken by some of the world's best scientists, we know that that's a trend that's going to continue. Climate change will increase not only the average temperatures and change kind of the average rainfall patterns, which will have effects on which crops can grow where and what the yields will be, what kind of varieties are suitable, what types of fertilizer and irrigation and pesticides are needed. But climate change also changes the frequency and the severity of extreme events. So we're going to be likely to see an increasing frequency of things like droughts and floods. And also when they happen, they're going to be worse, which is something that we've seen already occurring in recent years. And the kind of base changes that I mentioned in terms of temperature and level of rainfall, those require kind of ongoing adaptation on the part of farmers to be able to adapt to those changing realities without having their yields decrease. The shocks are much harder though, right? Because those are much more difficult to adapt to and they can wipe out an entire crop cycle. We see already some of the effects of climate if we look at what's happening currently in the Horn of Africa, where there's been a major drought that has resulted in deaths of millions of livestock and the loss of crops. And that is really exacerbating the food security situation within those countries. Mm-hmm. So climate change is only going to continue to exacerbate these challenges in the future and gives us kind of one more challenge that we need to address alongside the lingering effects of the pandemic and the widespread effects of the war.
Jeevan Santa, are we headed into a recession? What indicators do you look at to predict that?
Yeah, certainly looks like we are getting close to that point. I wouldn't at all be surprised if the world economy did plunge into it. And really at this point in time, we're kind of looking at the ways in which higher prices and lower demand in the future can impact it. We do have surveys, for example, on how people feel about consumer confidence as well as purchasing as well, especially for high income nations. And it kind of, if you like, those indicators are starting to point towards certainly much more negative growth. We've seen huge forecasts, or rather huge downgrade in global growth forecasts. That's hitting everybody. And in part of it, a huge part of it, of course, is the fact that, look, when it costs more money to produce things, it also means that actually you become less productive. And that also means less money consumer pockets to buy things. So certainly looks like a difficult year ahead for the global economy.
I was also interested, you know, there's a lot of talk in developed economies about a labour shortage, that businesses can't find workers because workers have more power now. I mean, is that the case also in developing economies, though? Is that a protective factor against going into a recession?
it's certainly, even if we are looking at a kind of a better employment outcomes, you know, here in the developed world, we tended to be able to lock down a lot more effectively for much longer periods of time. I think the other problem for those kind of developing nations isn't just about kind of the ways in which employment can feed through, but also the ways in which actually inflation is being controlled by global currency movements as well. So I think there's about a different set of challenges that developing nations are facing, and certainly kind of different situation with their labour markets as well.
Stella Nordhagen, what is the impact of sustained food insecurity, not just on physical health, but I guess societally?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of impacts. One of the areas of impact that we're the most worried about kind of in the food and nutrition community is when food security is experienced by pregnant women and young children early in their lives. Within nutrition, we refer to something that's called the 1,000 days window. And that's basically the period of time from conception until a child reaches their second birthday. And that's a period that's really critical for child development. And if you don't get enough to eat and also enough of the right things to eat, so enough vitamins, minerals, protein, as well as calories during that time, that can really lead to delays in development that persist throughout the lifetime. So talking about things like not achieving educational outcomes on level with one's peers, not achieving sufficient earnings later in life. And these are effects that they persist throughout the entire lifetime, and it's difficult to reverse when one tries to intervene at a later age. So we're particularly worried about those most vulnerable groups, pregnant women and young children. But really, sustained food insecurity at any point in life is a major difficulty for a person, a family, a community, a society to deal with. When school children don't get enough to eat, they don't concentrate in school, they don't learn well. When workers don't get enough to eat, they're not as productive, they don't deliver as much for society. But more importantly, not getting enough to eat and having to worry about where your next meal is coming from really degrades the quality of life and the enjoyment of life for everybody who is affected by it.
Of course.
And the longer that persists, it really translates into a large loss in terms of human experience.
All right, thank you very much to all of our guests, Stella Nordhagen, Jeevan Santa, and Kalyani Raghunathan. That's it for the Inside Story podcast. This episode was produced by Calvin Ng, Nihad El Abadi, Abdurrahman Warsame, and Jim Gilchrist. Studio sound was by Sasha Andrievich. The program was edited by Vishnu Sheila, Lynn Enwin, and Joe DeFrias. Be sure to subscribe to the Inside Story podcast to catch every episode. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back again on Wednesday.